trust your instincts.
Seems like a theme.
Trust your instincts to talk about, you know, your ideas. I think sometimes, especially in a room full of men, which has been, you know, what I've experienced most of my career, to really speak out, make a place for myself. I think I could have, you know, had even more of an impact on the businesses that I've worked at.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we learn from executives and founders about what they uniquely see that others don't when it comes to identifying top talent. This is your first episode. Welcome. So glad to have you. If you're a longtime listener, we obviously appreciate the support. Please subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And today we are actually joined by a very exciting guest. We are joined by Lynn Cherry. Lynn is a sports, media, and technology executive, most recently a chief legal officer and chief people officer. Lynn, how you doing?
I'm doing really well. Thank you.
Good to see you. You are the first episode of 2025. I got to start here. Any resolutions for the year? Anything you're thinking about as you go into what's hopefully a prosperous and healthy year for everybody?
Absolutely. I just went through this with my family and we set our resolutions and then we went around and set our resolutions for each other. So one of my resolutions was to be patient and be a better listener. And their resolutions for me is, my daughter's resolution for us as parents is to be more hands-off.
Okay.
So that was nice. She wants to be more independent.
Nice. What? How old is she?
She's 15.
Okay. All right. That sounds like I was just thinking in my head. I have a 13-year-old who's going on 25, and that sounds exactly like something she would have said to me and my wife in terms of her resolution for us. So I love that. I got to tell you, and I was a couple minutes behind getting this started. So your patience is already in the year 2025. You're doing an incredible job. My resolution outside of, you know, great professional success for both of my companies, being a better father, husband, friend, son, brother, all of that good stuff, was to wear more cardigans. And so I'm absolutely crushing my resolution at this point. For those that can't see, I am wearing a cardigan. So Lynn, I want to start here, and I appreciate you sharing a little bit, but you have a really, really interesting background, one that stood out to me when we first got to know each other. You have a combined legal and HR background, and you most recently were leading both of those functions, people and legal, at Wiseline. And I'd like to understand, like, what came first, chicken or the egg? Did you get into people and then wanted the legal component, or did you get into the legal side and then eventually move into people? Like, how did that work for you? Tell us a little bit about that journey.
That's a good question. So absolutely, I was a CLO first in legal and building legal teams and cultures within those legal teams. And I went to Wiseline, built the legal function there, and I was super honored to be asked to go to the people side. I admire the culture at Wiseline and felt strongly that talent is essential to the business of providing technology services. I think that there are a lot of skills in building legal that are directly transferable to human resources, including the ability to work across functions, build strong relationships with stakeholders, and really drive business objectives by being a servant leader.
Yeah, I love that. And I got to tell you, like, I know a lot of technology leaders, and a lot of the ones that I respect the most are people first leaders. My CFO famously goes by people first CFO, right? And then you look at legal, and these are not always functions that I'm always thinking about when I think about people. Tell me a little bit about why that decision was made by the CEO at the company. Did he know that this is something you were passionate about? Was it completely out of left field? Was there like a bunch of different conversations that led up to it? I'm just interested, like, maybe somebody who wants this for their career, what are things that they could maybe do to position themselves when they don't otherwise have that expertise?
That's a great question. So I do have a tremendous amount of employment legal experience on the legal side, but also any employment issue that you're handling has, you know, a real people side that we need to be sensitive about. I was particularly passionate about the culture at Wiseline, which came from the founder, who really believed in bringing sort of the Silicon Valley ideals to Mexico, where a lot of our talent existed. And I was head of DE&I, and we had a very inclusive environment where people had a lot of autonomy, and because of that, took a lot of responsibility for creating this environment where culture really felt a sense of belonging and thrived there. And I always understood that and appreciated it so much. It was my first sort of startup. It was really kind of a teenager as a company when I got there. And I felt very passionate. And I think that was obvious by, you know, it was obviously seen by the founder, and he appreciated that and saw that I could bring a lot to the function. And actually, I think going into HR, I came to it with such an open mind, appreciating the culture, but also looking at things with a lot of creativity and asking, you know, does it have to be this way? Why is it this way? And bringing in the team in that conversation and talking about very openly, like, how can we make this better? And I think that was something that I brought to the table that Bismarck, the founder of Wiseline, saw as well.
I really love that. Now, I got to tell you that in the past, when I have seen, because I've seen HR report up into legal, I've seen both legal and HR report up into chief administrative officers. I've seen a bunch of different things. And I'm always a big believer that you can tell a lot about an organization by its reporting structure, who reports to what, and how things are aligned, right, in terms of what they prioritize. And when I've seen HR and legal commingling in the past, I'll be honest, some of the assumptions I've had on what type of HR function that is, I don't know, it's not, maybe, I don't want to say not people first, because I think that's a little bit of a broad jump there, but maybe more focused on kind of like that compliance and governance aspect of the function. How have you managed to kind of decouple both of those and keep an effective talent strategy that's compliant and then working at its highest effectivity so those things are not coming into conflict?
Absolutely. I think I've always functioned as a lawyer from a very pragmatic and very business-minded approach. And in that way, I'm not a lawyer that says no. I'm a lawyer who gets into it with my stakeholders, really like decides what the problem is, what our priority is, and we figure out a creative solution to why yes. And I took that same approach in on the people side. How do we get to yes? How do we do things in a way that work for talent? I mean, you can't please everyone, but let's really listen to our talent. And we created communication channels that allowed us to listen and allowed our talent to really express themselves and feel heard, because sometimes that solves a lot. And as I mentioned, to bring the team in and be creative about our approach and not just do things the way that we did them in the past, I think bringing that sense of creativity also in addition to the business-minded approach was something that worked really well on the talent side.
I love that. That's awesome. One of the things I like a lot about you in particular and your experience and your career is that you've worked across so many industries, you know, telecom, athletics, media, technology, and you started your career at a little old place called MySpace. And what's funny is I'm reading a book right now called Platform Revolution that talks a lot about MySpace and Facebook and the different decisions that were made and how things were won. And so my first question, did you know Tom?
I did know Tom. You know, Tom was great because he had such a passion for the users and their experience of MySpace.
I love that. White t-shirt, yeah. Looking back in the picture, like I can still remember it like it's yesterday. What was it like working there so early on? And then I'm just interested, obviously, like when other sold like Friendster and Facebook, I'm interested, when did you start to first hear about Facebook and during that time? And how did you know start to see it as a real threat potentially?
Yeah. I went to MySpace shortly after News Corp bought them. And it was super exciting opportunity. I actually went as part of the leadership team that operated MySpace and a portfolio of internet properties that we acquired over time. And MySpace was on the cutting edge at that time. I mean, I saw it as the future of content distribution, and it really was that, especially around music, but also short form content. It was about 2 years into my time in MySpace that Facebook actually surpassed us. And I think it comes down to two really important factors, and factors that have taught me a lesson that I've taken with me throughout my career. And one lesson is user experience. When you saw Facebook, it was this elegant, clean, intuitive experience. And it created almost the feel of like when you go into a beautiful building and you feel like that spaciousness and that ability to think. And Facebook really had that. And MySpace, we were different. We were a place of expression. But in being that, there was some chaos in the site. And the second thing with the user experience is there was advertising on MySpace. Now there's advertising on all the social media platforms. But at that time, we were the only ones. And it was a big business. And I think at that time, because we were competing with Facebook, it was a bit of a disadvantage. But Facebook had the benefit of being able to operate without selling advertising. The second factor is technology. Technology is so important. And the MySpace platform was created very early on. The Facebook platform was new, took advantage of the newly developed technology. It was fast, it was responsive, and you could feel that in the user experience. And technology is really hard. And so MySpace was coming from a place of technology debt, trying to, you know, modify the site so that it could collect all the data and use all the data and be fast and nimble, and we could create the features and functionalities that we needed to, but it was tough. And I realized how tough technology is and how important it is.
Yeah, I remember, you know, I'm forgetting what year, sometime in the mid-aughts, and we had first started building our software, Aeon, and I was working with our Aeon team, our software team in India, and I was there, we were there for a meeting, and we were talking about, they were showing me what we could do. And I was looking at some of the internal stuff that we had been using from large monolith companies, and it was very comparable. And I was asking them, how is this possible that we're able to on a shoestring and gum, you know, budget here, make this happen and make something that's so, and the reality, the answer was those big companies assume so much technical debt over time. They're like an aircraft carrier that they can't pivot. They can't change. They can't be nimble. And there's a really big advantage to the insurgent, the one that can move and be quick. And that's why these startup environments tend to, you know, can have a lot of success, but then they become their own large monolith of companies, and then it's very different, right? And so I give Facebook a lot of credit for keeping their innovative mindset. And, you know, I got to be honest, a few years ago, it seemed like things were really on the decline. And then through a couple different acquisitions and then kind of moving off of the Web3 bet into the AI bet, they're stronger than ever. So it's, you know, it's just that nimbleness, that ability to move. And then the fact that technology changes, especially so much right now, there really is a big opportunity for companies on their way up, or startups like my own and other ones that I see out there, to be able to make a move. But then, you know, it all comes down to distribution and execution and all those other things that come into it. Because, you know, those companies didn't get big, you know, without being smart and knowing what they're doing. So it's a really, really fascinating thing. Another thing we talked about is that, you know, the companies that you've worked with had tech at the center of their business. And you said something to me, a Reed Hastings quote that I've actually repeated multiple times since, because I just found it to be super profound. And maybe I hadn't distilled it in this way. You said, Reed Hastings famously said, technology companies will become media companies before media companies can become technology companies, which I just found to be so profound and true. You've worked in both industries. I'm just interested, would you say this is one of the biggest reasons traditional media companies have struggled over the past 5 years? Their inability or maybe unwillingness to adopt being a true technology company, what that means, versus the technology companies were able to quickly become content providers and media providers. Much like you said, MySpace was on its way to being, you know, when you first started working there. Help me kind of walk through that and what you see in the media industry, being somebody that spent so much time in it.
Yeah, that's such an interesting idea. And Reed Hastings is just visionary, he was in that. The traditional media companies never had been direct to consumer. And I think because of the distribution relationships that they have with cable and satellite companies, they were slower to sort of transition to that direct to consumer. They had, you know, a lot of issues to work out with the distribution companies, which were their source of revenues. And so it was hard to move away. And I think because that took time, it sort of slowed their investment, the huge investment that it takes in technology and creating a user experience that is on a direct-to-consumer basis. It's really a whole different business model. But I think as we've seen the cord-cutting trends only increase, the media companies have gotten very good at technology and have made like the huge investments that are needed to create the kind of technology, the kind of user experience that is necessary to have a business where you're have a relationship, a direct relationship with consumers.
Well, there's a few different things. I don't know, this is the best thing, but you can be much more targeted and hyper targeted based on the type of way you want to consume media or how you want to frame your media. So that's one aspect of it. They already have the distribution down, right? They're already in your feed. They're already there. It's more a matter of going and hiring and creating brand resonance in the space and being seen as an authority in the space and maybe hiring some editors and hiring some people that can do and push out the content. Whereas if you're one of these larger companies that are some of my clients that will remain unnamed, you got to go invest in all this technology infrastructure and figure out how you can be out in front of the people in the real-time nature of the way that we consume media now. I mean, just think about a newspaper. Can you imagine waiting a day and a half to understand what happened yesterday, much like we did when we were growing up? And like, I'd go to the sports page to find out if my favorite team won versus now it's like I'm watching it on my phone in real time. Like, it's just everything in the way we consume, how much we consume, when we consume it, how we consume it is all so different. So I think it was an opportunity that technology saw. And let's be honest, they've gotten their tentacles into all different types of industries and fundamentally changed them. Where just for legacy media, it's just very, very difficult to make that pivot. Only the ones that really started doing it very early on are the ones that have managed to survive or even kind of pivot and kind of change the way that their company works altogether. One example I use is Time, you know, in a lot of ways being one of the most recognized brands, you know, growing up in terms of media publications. Now, in a lot of ways, events and the way that they center around their top 100 and things like that is how they create a moat around their business and how they stand out, right? In addition to the way that they serve media to the people. So I just think that, you know, all these different companies are wrestling with what's the right way to go about it. And it's really hard. And to the point we made earlier, when you're one of these big aircraft carriers, you know, pivoting like that can be really, really tough. So I think it's fascinating. I got a lot of friends in media. Some have left, to be honest. And I'm just interested to see how things start to change. But listen, I'm going to be real with you. I think all these industries are changing now, and we're going through one of the biggest labor disruptions we ever have in the next 5 to 10 years. And so I think there's a lot of companies and industries that are going to be wondering what's next and what's coming. There's a lot to come. Hopefully all positive, but we know there'll be byproducts that aren't exciting either. So remains to be seen. One last thing I want to ask you about Wiseline is that you were there kind of in the earliest stages of funding. I know you've since transitioned out, but I'm really interested about building a legal function and an HR function, because the approach of building both of those harmoniously seems a little bit tough to me. But I'm really also interested, like, did the legal aspect bleed into your mindset on the culture you wanted to build? Or did you completely decouple those things and say, I want to build this people-centric culture or whatever type of culture it is first, and then the legal side was, you know, built in a completely different compartmentalized capacity? Just interested in that as being somebody that was leading the charge on both of those.
I think there's so many similarities, actually, in terms of managing the team. I mean, the approach is very similar. Like, you have a team and you have to play to their individual strengths because it takes diversity to create a really strong team. So that's number one. Number two is you have to have like a strong cohesion and collaboration among your team. And we had team meetings every week, same as when I was in legal. And at those team meetings, I would give context about the direction of the company. And then people would talk about, what challenges they're facing, what their successes are. And so everyone sort of knew what everyone else was doing. And so everyone had a big picture. And so you felt like you knew your place in that picture and you knew where you could collaborate, especially. The concept of feedback on a continuous basis. I would have one-on-ones when I was both in legal and HR with my direct reports for sure, and with a lot of the others also, so that they knew where they stood. They, could get the coaching as well as the feedback that they needed, and I could check in on how they're doing mentally, physically. And then there's strategy, right? So, and this is true in both legal and HR. At the beginning of the year, we would all get together and come up with a strategy document and not look at just sort of tactical, what we have to do, but also things that are aspirational, what we want to accomplish, what would really make an impact on the business. Where could we really help to drive the business objectives? And we would align everything on the strategy document with the business objectives of the company. So, in terms of managing the team, I think it was very similar. And then, in terms of the culture, also a culture of being client-centric, being real partners with our stakeholders, being an extension of their team and meeting our clients where they needed us to be, being fast and responsive. Quality of the work, not that you can't make mistakes, mistakes are good, but where you have control, you need to ensure that there's quality and you're doing things correctly. I mean, mistakes are great. You learn from those, as Amy Edmondson, I think, has a great book on this, but what you control, you save a lot of headache down the road. And then the last is accountability. And that, again, that applies, both in the legal area in terms of a culture, having a healthy culture. And HR as well.
Love that. And it's amazing is that we have a lot of those same tenets here at our company in terms of our culture, but didn't look at it from the legal perspective. And what you're saying makes a lot of sense in terms of how there's more synergy there than you think. So I appreciate that. Very, very insightful. I want to make sure that we get a chance to talk about hiring because you've obviously done a lot of that throughout your career and been in some very large organizations, but also now in startup environments as well. And in both places, it's critical to get it right. So I want to start here. Whether it be for your team or how you advise the companies that you're kind of leading the charge around people or legal, what's kind of a core philosophy from your perspective on hiring for you, for your team?
So, I mean, of course, it's table stakes to have the right background. Sometimes, and this is easier in legal, I provide a test just to test basic skills. But I think that the sort of non-quantifiable factors are really important. And what I tend to look for is I love athletes, who especially athletes who were engaged in team sports. I love people who worked at a young age and have that hunger and aren't entitled, quite frankly. I love people with passion for what we're doing. Like, my passion is to support creative people, great inspirational people like athletes, like the storytellers in media, like engineers in technology are really like telling stories of how we live our lives online. And I want people who I hire to have that, to share that passion. And And talking about drive, in Miami, there are such incredible stories, like of people who actually came from other places where they had to leave their country. They had to, like Cuba and Venezuela, places in Central America. You know, there's a lot of Chileans and people from Argentina who, in a lot of cases, left everything, or their parents left everything, and they have this drive because they know that the generation before them sacrificed so much. And people who I've hired with those kind of stories, I mean, I'm attracted to that kind of story because it shows a drive and a hunger in a lot of cases. And then just team fit, you know, people who are nice. There's no room for people who aren't self-aware and empathetic.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite questions that maybe you ask in an interview to kind of identify if they've had adversity that they've overcome, or that they show that requisite lack of entitlement or grit that you think is important for hires?
I don't have any particular question, but I do ask people to tell me about themselves. Tell me, you know, about where they grew up. Tell me a little bit about their background, so that it's not all behavioral questions about what would you do in a certain business situation. I like to get to know people, and in person is preferable.
Sure. What about, you mentioned people that work early. What was your first job?
Oh, my first job, my father worked at kind of a precursor to a Walmart, but smaller, in the South. And I would work during Christmas from the time, maybe I was like 15. Maybe I had just started high school, because high school started 10th grade. And I remember being so tired from standing on my feet all day. And it really taught me how to work, how to get along with people. It was really important. And then I worked at a store, a gourmet store that a friend of my family's had. And I worked in the kitchen there. I worked as a waitress. Yes, I worked a lot.
Love that. My first job, and I had a lot of them in my teenage years, I was a referee. I was 13 years old. I was a referee for the YMCA, local YMCA in Arizona, for like eight or 9 year old basketball. And I was I was absolutely getting yelled at by parents and getting my head ripped off as a little 13 year old. So had to really, you know, put my foot down at certain times and make sure that I held my presence out there. But that was my first job and my first foray. My daughter's 13. I'm pushing them to get jobs as soon as they can, because I think you learn a lot from that. Like you said, there's a grit there. There's a lack of entitlement that comes with that. So I think it's really important.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
What about a memorable interview experience? Now, I'm kind of interested in this because I got to imagine that there, and you don't have to name names, but there's, being the chief legal officer, you've got to have heard of some crazy situations, some funny situations. Anything you can share? Maybe it was an interview you were in, or maybe it was something you interviewed for that would be a good story?
I mean, my own, you know, interviewing, you know, my great hires and my not so great hires, I did learn so many lessons from those. My great hires, just how important your instinct is. And it's either there, it's not. And my least successful hire, I rushed. I was just desperate to find someone. And against my instincts, I hired someone that I had to I knew after a week, I just got this pit in my stomach and I knew I had made a mistake. That was the way, it was so quick that I knew. And
what do you think you got wrong in that scenario? So I know you rushed, but like, if you had more time, what would you have done differently? Would you have asked different questions? Would you have gotten references? Like, what would you have done differently?
I would have gotten references and I would have given a test on legal skills. I think, and that's in the legal context. In the HR context, we would give situational because I wanted someone to have, I wanted to see if they were open-minded and rational thinkers and could put concise ideas on paper, because a lot of what we do is communication, you know, in email or in Slack. And so that's what went wrong. I rushed and I didn't trust my instinct.
I love that. So what about when you're trying to create an experience, a candidate experience that people will realistically understand what it's like to work with you or work at that company? Like, have you done anything innovative or unique in that space? Like, I know you mentioned earlier, you really like to be in person. Help me understand like how you create an experience that if you have that top person in front of you, that they're just dying to come work for you.
Yeah. So the culture, the tenets of the culture that I like to create, I go through that and I say, what do you think about this? And what do you think about this? And I go through the four areas and I really hear them out on what their thoughts are.
And then,
on each.
And so that you get them bought into that. Do you have anybody who self-selects out after that and says, maybe that's not me? Or do you get a sense of, you know, how do you think that helps?
No, I think it helps. I mean, you asked me, you know, how do I sort of sell my team? Mm. I mean, I don't want someone on my team who doesn't, you know, appreciate those sort of core tenets of the culture that I like to create. So I think it is about us getting on the same team. And, you know, with the people that I've hired, they've always been excited about that, how the team is managed and what the culture is like. That makes them feel good about and excited about joining.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier the best hires you've made. You don't have to name any names, but if I ask you the best hire you've ever made, does somebody come to mind?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. He, I knew the instant that I met him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
Did you do anything? Like, it was just in that moment and then it didn't matter what the process was because you already knew so early on, or was there anything unique you did in the process to kind of identify that? Did he end up surpassing expectations of what you'd even hoped before then? Or how did you get that one so right?
That one was pure instinct. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I was so sure. And I did have references there.
And it worked.
But I was able to meet with him in person a few times. You know, so I did meet more than once.
That helped.
But I do, I mean, that's something, you know, to have a meal with someone, you really know. And it also allows you to, you know, you were asking me, how do you get to some of those, you know, non-quantifiable factors? How do you understand those? And it really is. I mean, there's no shortcut. It's really like spending time with someone. And I love being remote and being able to connect with people virtually, but there really is no substitute for being face to face.
Totally agree. All right, let's take it a little bit of a different direction. I want to know any books you might have read recently or any content you might have seen that you'd recommend for our listeners that you really loved?
Well, entertainment content?
Anything.
Or
I want something to watch on TV or a good book to read. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. Wicked is amazing. I went to see that with my daughter. And it's
listening to Defying Gravity in the car ride to school this morning. So I know it all too well.
I mean, it is a movie that has like that quality of just a major motion picture, like a real, even though it was an existing story, it was a Broadway play, but it does have just that beauty, that artistic element that makes it so special. So I did really love that.
I think one of the things I like about that movie, and just what I've seen in I guess all movies and Broadway and books as well, but when there's an established concept that's out there, like a known story, and then they reframe it in a way that you would have never like really thought or considered, I think people love that and enjoy that. Because if you look at Hamilton, right, that was a completely unique and different take on talking about American history and wrapping it and having, you know, more people of color playing those roles. And just, it was such a moment and so great. But when you went for it the first time, you're like, what is this? This is amazing. And you're singing. And the same thing with Wicked. Like, I mean, My Name is Oz. I mean, if you want to know, the number one thing people have said to me in my life when they first meet me is like, the Wizard of Oz. So I'm pretty familiar with the play and the movie, seen it all. And I didn't know what Wicked was about. My kids, my daughters and wife in particular, are really into theater. So they went and saw it, was in Miami. And I kind of knew what it was about. And then I took my daughters to see it in the theater. And what I really didn't understand is that it was like, hey, this is how the Wicked Witch became the Wicked Witch. And maybe she's a little bit misunderstood. And I don't know, man. I just found that really, really fascinating. And I was like, wow, this is really, really good. So, and of course, I thought the singing and the, like you said, the effects and the costumes and everything were just really incredible. So high regards to Wicked. It sounds like you had another recommendation. What else?
Well, also, this Amy Edmondson book, you know, I love her. She, you know, this whole concept of psychological safety and people being able to bring, you know, their thoughts and themselves and their perspective to, you know, how you're building teams and how you're solving issues in the business world. And so she wrote a book about failure, about the right kind of failure, and about how important it is for, you know, teaching us how to do things right.
Do you have the name of the book, or should we put it in the show notes?
You have, let's put it in the show notes.
Put it in the show notes. Amy Edmondson. Yeah. Okay, good stuff.
Yes.
Okay. I want to get to our lightning round, because I'm going to ask you some Florida-based questions, because I know you're out here in South Florida like I am, and we have a national, international listening base, so we're going to give them some thoughts and ideas on what the best experiences are here. But before we do that, I want to ask you, what's some advice maybe you'd give your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then but that you know now?
Trust your instincts.
Seems like a theme. Tell me more.
Yeah. Trust your instincts to talk about, you know, your ideas. I think sometimes, especially in a room full of men, which has been, you know, what I've experienced most of my career, to really speak out and make a place for myself. And I wish I would have done that earlier. You know, I think I could have, you know, had even more of an impact on the businesses that I've worked at.
Love that. You hear that, kids? Mm-hmm. Trust your gut.
Yes.
All right. So we'll do lightning round. So you are and were an adjunct professor at the University of Miami. It looks like you attended the College of Law at the University of Florida. You're a member of the Florida Bar. How long have you lived in South Florida?
Oof. For over 25 years.
All right, here we go. Lightning round. What is the best city outside of South Florida to spend time in Florida?
Oh, in Florida. I thought you were going to say, you know, in the U.S.
That's too big of a question.
In the world. The best city to spend time in. I really loved where I grew up in Jacksonville. And I love Tampa, too. I have family in both places. I love the beaches in Jacksonville.
Okay, so those are, beach. Is it St. Augustine? What beach are you thinking of?
St. Augustine and Ponte Vedra.
Ponte Vedra, okay. Mm-hmm. Favorite restaurant in Florida? If you had somebody coming in from out of town, you'd say, you got to go eat here.
I love Joe's.
Joe's Crab?
Joe's Stone Crabs, uh-huh.
Love that.
It's such a classic Florida
experience.
It really is an experience.
Got to get that mustard dipping sauce, though. That's the key.
Oh, so good.
Absolutely incredible. What's a, you know, whether it be a theme park or a place, like where like maybe going in and checking out the Everglades, like what's like a quintessential Florida experience you'd recommend to somebody?
I mean, I would have to say the Disney experience.
Okay, what's
it
your
really
favorite park,
Disney
favorite,
is
like what would you tell somebody to do if they were going to go do the Disney experience?
If you have to do one, you have to do the Magic Kingdom.
Agreed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, especially if you haven't been, it really, Disney is an incredible company. I have so much respect for them. They've done a great job in their streaming business.
Yes, they have. Yes, they have. Mm-hmm. And Wicked will be out on Disney Plus. Not that they are a sponsor of us, but if you want to check out Wicked, I think by the time this podcast come out, you might be able to check it out on there. So what I would tell you is, last question, I want to know two famous Florida food champions, key lime pie or a Cuban sandwich. Which one?
That's so hard. I would have to say a Cuban sandwich.
Oh,
That's just so classic.
Ham, pork, mustard. You've got the flattened grilled bread. Yeah, I wasn't too exposed to Cuban food until I moved here. I grew up on the West Coast of the United States, so I ate a lot of Mexican food, obviously. But coming here and getting Cuban food, Peruvian food, Argentinian food,
so
one of the best parts about being in South Florida.
And my brother, who's in Tampa, we have a running competition on whose Cuban sandwich is the best.
Between you and him making them?
No. Just
Tampa versus
between
Miami.
Like a typical, typical Cuban sandwich,
okay,
you get here.
I mean, I'm putting my vote in for Miami. There's got to be a way
Miami,
bigger Cuban population.
Hands down.
Come on. All right. Well, listen, Lynn, I really appreciate you coming on. It's fun. I appreciate it. I'm so glad that we've got to develop this relationship. So much great insights from you. I really appreciate you spending a little time with me.
Thank you so much, Oz. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.